Hello again, I'm Armin Alney. The effort to legalize same-sex marriage was moving faster than the most optimistic supporters ever expected until the U.S. Supreme Court made two rulings a couple of weeks ago. Did the court accelerate the process, as many advocates have concluded, or did it apply the brakes? We'll talk about that later on To the Point. First, a follow-up story to one we aired on Tuesday. The Center for Investigative Reporting discovered that 150 pregnant women were sterilized in California prisons between 2006 and 2010 without the required notification to top state medical officials. Inmates and their advocates said they were pushed to sign up, and a prison doctor said the cost was minimal compared to potential welfare payments for unwanted children. Some legislators are outraged. Hannah Beth Jackson is state senator from Santa Barbara and chair of the Women's Caucus. Senator, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us about your response to this story.
Well, of course, when we learned from this report that there had been 150 women who had been sterilized while in prison, we were very, very concerned, very appalled, I think, as the public was. So we immediately intervened. We contacted the federal receiver who was in charge of providing the health care in the prisons, actually had a meeting with him in which we grilled him on this procedure. We know that we had been told it had stopped in 2010. We have no reason to believe that it has continued, but we want to make sure that this procedure, this process, completely terminated and will not be pursued again in the future.
Does it appear any laws might have been violated?
Well, it does appear that the proper procedures were not followed, that the federal law prohibits the use of any federal money whatsoever for these procedures. State law prohibits them except if certain procedures are followed. They were clearly not followed.
What about doctors who tried to encourage women to get tubal ligations?
Well, we have also sent a letter through the chair of the Business and Professions Committee, which oversees the California Medical Examiners Board, Medical Board, excuse me, to do an investigation of these doctors. We know that they no longer work at the prisons or with these prison inmates, but we also have called upon them to do an investigation into this these doctors and their behavior, and to take whatever steps are appropriate given the whatever actions were taken that we believe were contrary not only to policy but probably to existing law.
What about a doctor who says that this is worth the cost because it will save the welfare that might be required for unwanted children?
Well, that's obviously an appalling statement in the first place, but coming from a doctor whose primary responsibility is to do no harm is just unacceptable. And we, of course, have called for an investigation of this doctor and any of the other doctors who were performing these procedures without getting the proper, going through the proper procedures. And frankly, even then, you have women who are in prison. There's a real question about whether one can make a knowing and willing waiver when you're in a coercive situation like that, which is, again, one of the things that we want to take a very careful look at.
That brings up the subject that the federal receiver has said, which is that consent forms apparently were signed.
Well, you know, when you're shackled to a gurney and you're giving birth and you're under sedation, it's hard to imagine that that really can be construed as consent. And I'm sure there were some of these consent forms signed, but the question is, were they made voluntarily? And clearly, with the number of women who have stepped forward, and we now know that there are about 150 who are saying that they were these were not willing and knowing waivers of their rights, that this is something we've got to fully examine and make sure it doesn't happen again.
You spoke to a federal receiver because the federal courts have taken over the medical system in the prisons in California. Did the receiver accept responsibility for this? It happened on his watch.
Well, certainly he needs to accept responsibility. What he told us was that there were no real procedures in place, that the prisons didn't make a point of requiring a process by which these kinds of invoices, believe it or not, it really was, they discovered it because these doctors would submit invoices for payment for these procedures, and there was no oversight, and the receiver says that he has now implemented a procedure by which there will be no payment if these procedures are done. And sadly, or happily, I'm not quite sure what, we're not, the doctors want to get paid, and knowing they're not going to get paid, they're not performing them.
Very quickly, this sort of harks back to the awful history of forced sterilization and eugenics in California.
Absolutely, and it's very, very distressing that this kind of behavior continues even into the 21st century, which is another reason that we're so concerned. You know, it hasn't been that many years that women weren't actually shackled while they were giving birth. I mean, the way these women have been treated in prison is just reprehensible, and in fact, it was part of the subject of the promises that we were able to extract from the receiver that going forward, we believe that a women's health program with a director whose focus and mandate is to ensure women's physical and mental health will be seriously considered, and we expect will be implemented by this receiver so this kind of behavior doesn't happen again.
Annabeth Jackson, State Senator from Santa Barbara, Vice Chair of the Legislative Women's Caucus. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We'll be right back with Which Way LA.
Subscribe to the Which Way LA podcast at kcrw.com/whichwayla or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find Which Way LA on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
We're on Alney back with Which Way LA. Now that the San Onofre nuclear power plant has been shut down, Southern California Edison needs new sources for one-fifth of Southern California's electrical power. It also has to get rid of the plant itself, including components that will be highly radioactive for a very long time. First, the replacement power. Morgan Lee reports on energy and green business for UT San Diego. Morgan Lee, good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Green business certainly brings up one of the issues because there are no emissions from nuclear power, but there will be by from the replacement.
Yeah, yesterday at a Senate hearing, Edison was already estimating how much more greenhouse gases are going to be coming from natural gas plants as a result of the outage. And there are some, you know, there are some green solutions out there. This is putting on the front burner, you know, what are going to be the impacts of new programs for energy efficiency, for distributed generation like solar rooftops. It's really forcing the state authorities and the utilities to account for the money that's been spent on those programs.
What are they going to do in the meantime before they can get those things into, presuming they decide to go that direction, but before they can get those things up and running?
Sure. Well, they've been working since January of last year when the outage first started on mainly transmission upgrades that can free the flow of energy, allow them to move energy around the grid in this area. And there's been synchronous condensers, which is voltage support equipment that's been installed at the Huntington Beach plant. And that helps them, again, to import more power. Without this baseload constant energy coming from San Onofre, it becomes tougher to draw in energy from out of state, and this is a region that really relies on that outside power and being able to move energy up and down the coast.
Will any of the new energy be from coal?
Not likely. California has pretty much phased almost all coal generation out of its portfolio. And natural gas is already a big part of the solution, but there too, there's going to be some push and pull. Here in San Diego County, SDG&E, the investor-owned utility for the region, has revived a plan that they pitched a couple years ago for a big natural gas peaker plant near the Mexico border. But there's a lot of pushback on that from ratepayer advocates, from people who say that we've been spending a lot of money trying to bring online utility-scale solar and wind plants, and that those should be integrated in the grid, and that we need to account for all the money that's been spent replacing light bulbs and improving the efficiency of buildings before we start talking about building new power plants.
What about the cost of the new power, particularly if they have to move it around the way you describe it? Does that increase the cost?
There's expected to be some cost increases, and I haven't seen good numbers on that yet. There's one of the problems they talk about is in utility, you know, lingo is congestion, that as transmission becomes a little bit constrained because don't have the plant to move things around as well, well, then that puts some pressure on markets and short-term prices start to go up.
So we got natural gas then. We've got solar and wind possibilities coming up. What about brownouts this summer?
Well, you know, the region did pretty well last summer without the plant, and that was a slightly hotter than average summer. Now there's talk that with the economic revival, you know, limited, but that there could be increased demand this summer, and a lot of it just depends on the weather. But there's big margins built in to planning, and so it would have to be extraordinary heat wave and there would have to be some major transmission and generation unplanned outages.
And we're talking mainly about San Diego County and Southern Orange County. Is that correct?
Yeah, those are where the most concern is, according to the main grid operator for the state, the California Independent System Operator, and also according to utility officials. There are several either reconditioned or new natural gas plants coming online in the Los Angeles basin. There's concerns that they're not quite in the right places because they weren't, you know, planned or built with this in mind, but those are supposed to help.
Morgan Lee again, energy and green business reporter for UT San Diego. San Onofre has two nuclear reactors under those big domes you see when you drive south of San Clemente on Interstate 5. Dave Lockbaum is a former nuclear plant operator. He's now director of nuclear safety projects at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Good to have you on our program.
Hello, Warren. Thank you.
Tell us what decommissioning the nuclear power plants means.
Basically, workers will go through the plant to survey it for radiation sources, both ground and soil, as well as components of the plant, concrete walls and metal pipes. They'll bin that material into material that's clean and can be sent to municipal landfills or recycled. Material that's slightly contaminated, and if the contaminated layer of paint or, you know, an inch of concrete were removed, the rest of it would be clean. And then there's other components that are so radioactively contaminated, they have to go to special radioactive dumps for handling. In addition, there's also the spent fuel that is awaiting in California and elsewhere for the federal government to come up with a repository for it. So the first step will be go through, survey the plant, see what they've got, where it is, and then figure out what to do with it and dispatch of it to the appropriate place.
Is there going to be a large amount of material for a long period of time as the plant cools down that's really very highly radioactive?
The longest-lived material would be the spent fuel. That needs to be isolated from the environment for at least 10,000 years, give or take a few minutes. The rest of the material may be in large quantity, but it can be disposed of more readily because it's not quite as radioactive, and it's not in a form. It's like the metal pot that holds the reactor core. It's fairly easy to maintain. It's not going to get into the groundwater or things like that. So it's, even though it has to be isolated for a long period of time, it's pretty easy to do so because it's not easily transported.
What about the safety of the operation? Is it a pretty dangerous thing for workers to do?
Early on, about 20 years ago, when nuclear plant decommissioning first started, there were some problems that were encountered. For example, cutting up piping and concrete walls released a lot of radioactive particles into the air that workers could breathe. Nowadays, things have gotten more sophisticated. A lot of that cutting is done underwater or with water to keep down the radioactive cloud that is formed. So as more and more plants went through decommissioning, there was a learning curve that benefits the workers that will undertake this activity at San Onofre.
There was a radioactive plant, or a nuclear plant, I should say, decommissioned way up in the northern part of California a long time ago, and a couple of reactors in Sacramento were decommissioned as well. But are there people around who know how to do this?
There were. There's been more than a dozen plants across the United States that have gone through decommissioning. So there's been there for a while, it was the growth industry within the nuclear industry, the people tearing down plants because there weren't any being built. So that was the place to find money. So there are a number of companies around the United States and across the globe who kind of specialized in this project. For example, within the last year, the two reactors at the Zion plant outside of Chicago, Illinois, its owner turned over the decommissioning job to a company who's going to do the decommissioning entirely. The original owner's basically just going to watch as this other company comes in and does it.
Okay, well, we will see what happens at San Onofre and, of course, what the decommissioning will cost, as well as what it will cost to replace the power. Dave Lochbaum, again, at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Morgan Lee with UT San Diego. Thank you both for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Thank you.
In a moment, the edge of the solar system on Which Way LA.
You're listening to Which Way LA from KCRW. Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/whichwayla or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at WWLA.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. The Voyager 1 spacecraft was launched in 1977, 36 years ago, and it is still sending messages home. Scientists thought it would have reached the edge of the solar system by now, but it's 11 billion miles from the sun, and it hasn't gotten there yet. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez talked with Caltech Professor Ed Stone. He's former head of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and lead scientist of the Voyager program since 1972. He was there from the beginning.
He was there from the beginning, even before that, because, you know, they had to plan this years before 1977. Yeah. And let's talk about 1977. Let's put this in perspective. People can understand pop culture perspective. 1977, what's popular in the United States? Farrah Fawcett Majors, you know, the poster of her up on kids' walls. Starsky and Hutch, Roots premiered that year. We had the New York City blackout. So that's when these vehicles were launched. It's only now 36 plus years later that they're starting to get to the edge of our solar system. Where are they exactly? Well, let's have Ed Stone talk about that.
The sun creates a huge bubble around itself called the heliosphere. The atmosphere of the sun is expanding outward at 1,000,000 miles per hour or more. That creates this giant bubble. All the planets are well inside this bubble. And inside the bubble is material that's come from our sun, the magnetic field from our sun. And Voyager 1 is now very near the edge of that bubble. Outside the bubble is interstellar space.
And interstellar space. So it's that vast chasm between our star and the rest of the galaxy, the rest of the universe.
But they thought they were going to be at the edge by now, and yet they've sort of discovered that there's not quite an edge.
It's actually an interesting story. Somebody actually announced that Voyager 1 was officially outside of our solar system. They had to walk that back, though, because there's an ongoing discussion among scientists of where the edge is. And it's very fuzzy. It's very wise. Essentially, it's a place where the sun's material influence, the particles it shoots out, start to wane completely. And then the rest of the galaxy, what's beyond our solar system, takes over. And it'll take Voyager 1 several months, even years still, to traverse this. And then scientists will say, they'll come to a consensus and say, this vehicle and its sister vehicle, Voyager 2, are outside of our solar system. I also want to say very quickly, let's give these vehicles props for what they've done. Their chief mission was to explore the outer planets. They found amazing things like volcanoes on Io, moon of Jupiter, the amazingly complex architecture of Saturn's rings, Neptune and its weird and quirky magnetic field. They found like 6 moons just around Neptune alone. So we've already gotten our money's worth out of these craft. Everything else beyond this is just kind of it's sauce, it's gravy. Now, where are these craft going? They're going out to the great beyond. And let's go back to Ed Stone talking about where they're going and how long they'll be there.
These two spacecraft will be in orbit around the center of our galaxy. So every few hundred million years, they will complete one orbit around the center of our galaxy, along with all the stars. They will leave the solar system itself far behind in the billions of years ahead.
And they'll become true starships.
They will become our silent ambassadors to the Milky Way.
Could they outlive the Earth itself?
They could will likely outlive the Earth, because here's the bad news. Our world will end one day. The sun, will go supernova. It'll expand out beyond the borders of the orbit of Earth. But these craft will be safe from that. They'll still be out there, and they'll be, you know, it'll take them.
Sending messages, but there won't be anybody to get them.
Well, Voyager 1 has enough juice in it for about 8 to 10 more years of communication with Earth. Then it's going to go dark. So we're going to learn things still for another 8 to 10 years. Then it's going to go dark. Then it's going to be all by its lonesome. But we have a message. Earth, you know, Carl Sagan, in back in the 1970s, says, hey, we are sending these craft out there. Along with their instrumentation, we should send a message. We should send something about ourselves. So aboard each vessel, aboard each craft, there's a record, a 12-inch copper record encased in gold. It has sounds of Earth. It has visuals of Earth. And this is what and the idea is maybe someday somebody will find it. It'll go, you know, alien hands will touch it, and they'll learn about our planet. And here's what Ed Stone has to say about that.
Well, I think it's the message on the record really is a message to all of us on Earth that we could actually send such a message. When you think about it, it's really quite remarkable. The likelihood it will be found is very small. So it's really more of a message for us than it is for any intelligent being that will find it.
Meaning what? Meaning it's an example of what we can do.
It's a statement of what we can do, what we could do in 1977. We could actually build a spacecraft that will do these things and would, in fact, head off on its own journey into the Milky Way.
Aren't there examples of popular culture on that gold record? At least there were reports that there would be at some point.
Let's do this. Why don't we go to a sample? I've edited together three quick selections. The audience will recognize two of them, I think, pretty easily. I'll translate the third one. Here's an example of what's on those gold records.
Oh, come on now. Hello
from the children of planet Earth.
太空朋友，您好，您吃饱未？有闲就来阮家坐哦。
Now, that was the sounds of a child with a mother. You know, the sound of Earth, really, synonymous with Earth. The greetings in English, and then greetings in Amoy. And let me translate that last thing. Amoy is a language spoken in southern China. Translated, that person said, friends of space, how are you? Have you eaten yet? Come visit us if you have time, which I think is a great homie touch. If I had a choice between all the greetings, I'd go to that place on our planet to have some food. There are also examples of music, everything, you know, from Schubert, Bach to early rock and roll, Louis Armstrong. Other sounds of Earth include the sounds of, you know, crickets, thunderstorms. No sounds of violence, which I think is interesting. It's like we're putting our best foot forward. This is kind of like we're going on a date, you know, and we're saying just how great and wonderful we are. But there's some cosmetic work on this record. It doesn't show everything there is to know about humanity. And then also on the record, there are instructions as to how to play it, because what good is it, you know, if the alien hands are holding this thing, then they don't know how to play it. So hopefully the thinking is if they're smart enough to get their hands or, you know, whatever they have for hands on this record with these instructions, they'll figure out how to play it. There's also, and this is somewhat controversial, there's also a little graph showing our location in the universe, our location in the galaxy. And some people say that may not be such a good idea to be so clear about where we are.
There used to be a good joke about the space aliens getting the record and sending back the message, send more Chuck Berry.
Oh, Chuck Berry's on it. Thank you for reminding me that. Chuck Berry's on it. And who knows, if we do this again, maybe we can use the KCRW, you know, Jason Bentley genius, and he'll add something to it, or Ann Litt. But what Ed Stone would like to see in the future, the scientist we talked to from JPL, the lead scientist on this project, is let's start thinking about building purpose-built craft that for interstellar flight. Let's start sending more stuff out of our solar system, both for scientific exploration and also just to get more stuff off of our planet. So if something does happen to our world, there are more remnants of who we were as a civilization out there in the cosmos. It's kind of the idea is we live on if these craft are out there someplace.
Back to the very beginning of our conversation, how long is it going to take, or does anybody have really any very good idea at this point, until outer space is truly reached and the Voyager 1 has gone where no artificial object has ever gone before?
Probably in the next year to 3 years. And I hate to be so fuzzy about that. It's just that the scientists don't know themselves. This will be somewhat akin to what happened with Pluto. Remember the controversy there? Is this a planet? Is this not a planet? It took years to hash that out and for scientists to come to a conclusion that no, Pluto is not a planet. I think it'll be the same thing here when it comes to Voyager 1 and 2 and, you know, scientists coming to this mutual conclusion, yes, we can say this is now a true interstellar craft. It is beyond the boundaries of our solar system. But that's a little ways off. I guess what we can say is it's at the front door of being outside of our solar system and into whatever is beyond. beyond it. And that, and it'll, again, keep in mind, it'll still be sending us back information. There's a little radioactive material on plutonium. And as it decays, it creates heat aboard the spacecraft, which is turned into electricity. And it's very, I mean, frankly, I think the lights in our studio probably have more juice in them than what powers the spacecraft. Yeah. But it's enough to keep the radio antenna working, some of the instrumentation working. And it, you know, like to quote an advertisement from the time when it was launched, Timex, it takes a licking, but keeps on ticking. Same thing with Voyager 1 and Voyager 2.
And a lot to be learned about cosmic rays coming from outer space, about the magnetic influence of the sun. A lot of science is involved in all of this.
More than we can get into, Warren, here. But if the audience is curious about this subject matter and curious about Voyager 1 and 2, go to the Which Way LA blog. We have a longer conversation with Ed Stone there and photos of this amazing golden record and the spacecraft and some of the images shot by Voyager 1 and 2.
Saul Gonzalez, as always, a lot of fun. Good to have you.
Much fun here, too, Warren.
Remember, you can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, same-sex marriage, the U.S. Supreme Court, and the states. That's on To the Point.